we are here to consider some of the general features of our own life as the human species. Which direct and decide upon human relationships and consequently the solidarity of mankind. Human relation is the primary consideration in the organizations in the world which go by the name of nations or governments or even lesser bodies than these wider systems of management. We have come to learn by practical experience that our life is social as far as our daily needs are concerned and our conduct is also related. This peculiar relation which people bear among themselves is a subject of deep study among circles of academies and universities under the title Humanities, which cover a vast range of studies into the psychology and sociology of human behavior. The behavior of a person or the conduct of a body of people is generally known as the culture of that person or the culture of the people. Students of history and humanities are acquainted with the great cultures of the world which are imposing and enlightening for a student of anthropology and of the behaviors of the human minds through the passage of time. When you read the history of the cultures of the world, you seem to be reading through a drama of human activity, like the plays of Shakespeare or of Kalidas, where human conduct and psychological maneuver are portrayed in such an interesting manner that they seem to touch our own hearts and incidentally guide us also in our day-to-day affairs. History is a great lesson even to us today at the present moment. We do not study the history of mankind merely to amuse ourselves with a story of ancient times. It is their instruction to us at the present moment in regard to our own social conduct. The ancient cultures, to the knowledge of man at the present time, are the well-known antique studies of human nature, beginning with the Babylonian or the Assyrian, the Egyptian, the Greek, the Roman, the Chinese, the Indian, and the later offshoots of these major organizations of human behavior. I would like to regard culture as a behavior of human nature. It is the upbringing of the social unit that man is, which speaks in the language of the culture of that person. We generally say, so and so is a culture person. Though we may not be actually defining culture at that time in an academic manner, we have in our mind some idea as to what culture is. We associate goodness, politeness, humility, servicefulness, and a capacity to understand and feel the circumstances and the position of other people when we conceive of the structure or character of culture. Great historians like H.G. Wells, who have written an outline of the history of the world, and who have made studies in this line, like Arnold Toynbee, have covered an area of study which may be said to constitute every little minute detail of psychological thought. You will be surprised that many of the cultures have died and they do not seem to be practically visible even in a remnant form these days. We have to dig out the bowels of the earth to find out if there is any remainder of those ancient cultures of these antediluvian times. Cultures perish and they do not seem to be surviving through the passage of time. The reason behind which also should become an interesting subject of our studies. Students of culture and history have very carefully come to the conclusion, when cultures do not find it possible to accommodate themselves with the requirements of the passage of time, they become moribund and die out. The world moves through the passage of history, you may call it the passage of time. We people who have lived a few years in this world, maybe 20 or 30 years or 40, 50 years, have seen how time moves. Don't you feel that you have the necessity in your day-to-day existence to adjust and accommodate yourself with the requirements of time? Do you stick on to an old dogma of yours which was valid 20 years ago? It must have been a valid ideal, no doubt, but that validity has become an outdated significance under the circumstances that prevail today, for instance. Thus it is, the great teacher Acharya Shankara mentions in one of his commentaries that dharma, which is the law of life, is relative to place, time and circumstance. It is not a rigid Procrustean belt into which every person is tied, whatever he be and wherever he be. Thus, cultures seem to be relative adjustments and envisagements or outlooks of mankind under certain geographical and social conditions. We gather from an interesting reading of mighty histories of the ancient past, like the history of Greece, or a more interesting dramatic history written by Edward Gibbon, under the title The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire are not merely stories told us, but they are tremendous lessons of mankind's culture, telling us why they perished. India also has its own culture, had own culture, it has its culture even today. It has been a surprise to many students of history how, under the vicissitudes of time and the onslaughts of inimical forces, India's culture should still be able to show its head above the surface of the earth and not be buried under the debris of the ground as other cultures had their fate. A great student of India's culture is Sri Aurobindo, and we had many other scholars of this type who opine that if India is alive today in consonance with the basic requirements of its own ancient culture, it is because of the spirituality of its author. Here we have to strike a very cautious note when we speak of the spiritual outlook of India, about which we may have time to think over a little deeply later on, because we are likely suddenly to jump into the conclusion that spirituality means a God-seeking mentality of man, which consequently implies also perhaps a kind of indifference towards the values of social and practical life. These are matters which require very deep consideration in our own personal, social and political interest. Roman culture and Greek culture were mighty cultures, no doubt, but they do not exist for a single reason, namely the incapacity of those cultures to accommodate themselves with the requirements of the passage of time. When the time required them to change their ideals and ideologies, they refused, and they were crushed by the iron hands of nature. Nature is not a respecter of persons. Nature has no friends, even as nature has no enemies. Nature has a purpose. This is something very important to remember. Nature loves only its purpose and nothing else. And it loves also all those people who are in a position to help in the fulfillment of its purpose. Those who are adamantly clinging to an ideal, which was once upon a time in conformity with certain activities of nature in the interest of the fulfillment of its own purpose, but which now are not required, will be something which nature will shun. Diet is a necessity for the human body, but it does not mean the same diet should be given to the body under every circumstance at every time, because the conditions of the body will tell what type of diet is necessary, or any diet is necessary at all under certain conditions. So while nature requires that everyone should exist, he does not wish that anybody should perish, but the intention of nature is not the perpetuation of individual forms, but ideals and ideologies. This is again a deep theme that is hidden behind the outer history of mankind's formations. Human history, when it is studied in a philosophical manner, not as we study in high schools, in a deeper sense, becomes a study of ideals and ideologies rather than the activities of kings and queens or the dates of wars that took place, etc. History does not mean the story of kings and queens. It is something else from the point of view of the nature or the universe as a whole. If kings and queens were the only important things, they would not have died. But they were not important. They were necessary as certain vehicles or instruments for the fulfillment of a purpose which was more impersonal than their persons. But cultures like the Roman, to give only one instance among any, stuck to the personalities and the ideals of the persons and the groups of individuals then, rather than the flexibility that nature would have expected from them in the interaction of a larger purpose which was not merely Roman. Because nature is not Roman or Greek. It has a wider eye than the Roman eye or the Greek eye or anybody's eye. So anyone who cannot see through the eyes of nature will not be permitted to live. This is something very important to know. There is no use a Mr. or a Mrs. looking at things and then insisting that those visions should persist always. You are saved only if you are in a position to collaborate with the ideals of nature. These cultures which are not seen today have died out because nature does not want them, because they clung to forms, and nature does not want forms merely. Just as we are not fond of motor cars only, because motor cars are necessary for some purpose at certain times. If the purpose is not served by the position of a motor car, the car has no value. The vehicle itself is not the importance. The purpose it serves or is expected to serve is the importance. So when an individual or a group of individuals or a culture, as you may call it, cannot serve the purpose which is the great intention of nature as a whole, they are cast aside. They are given an exit order, like the director of a drama who throws the screen on the face of an individual whose role is over in that enactment. All great men have gone, and no one can remain. No one can remain because all these someones or anyones are forms projected by the intentions of nature for the fulfillment of its own superpersonal purpose. And we are unable to understand this philosophy of nature. We think that the body itself is that which nature is affectionate about, and we think that life is nothing but possession of buildings, lands, currencies, etc. But life is not the possession of buildings, lands and currencies. These are again like motor cars. The buildings that you have, the lands and the monies that you have are vehicles which you are permitted to have, provided that they fulfill a purpose, or rather the purpose, which is the intention of nature. Otherwise, you will be dispossessed of these ideals. Your money will go, your property will go, your land will go, everything goes, even the body may go. Because the world is a large visualization in the supreme eye of God, perhaps. And it is not a house built for any person like us. So, cultures which were rigid, adamant, egoistic, you may say, and were not prepared to understand the requirements of the movement of time, had to receive a blow or a kick from nature's requirements, and they are no more. We read only in H.G. Wells and not see today in the original form. We are thinking of pinpointing our attention on certain cultures which are existing today and not died out like the Roman or the Greek. A great example before us is the culture of India. which has not died, in spite of the tortures to which it was subjected through the histories of times. Students of Indian history know the troubles and the difficulties through which people in India had to pass. It is a wonder that they are not perished. And one of the reasons discovered behind this persistence of the culture of India is the accommodating capacity of the culture of India, which does not reject the ideals of the past and does not ignore the ideals that may advance in the future, and does not also turn a deaf ear to the calls of the other cultures of the world that are existing even today. The vision of India may be said to be an impersonal vision, which by chance or by the grace of God or by a miracle, as you would like to say, it has been able to enter. Today people in India are a medley of various problems and memories of the past, hopes of the future, and so on. In spite of this, there is a little candle flame burning in the little corners of the country, which cries out in the language of the ancient culture, nevertheless. One of the reasons is the accommodating capacity of the culture, I told you. You would be wondering, what is this accommodation? And where comes the necessity or the ability to entertain such a view? The ability to accommodate oneself with other people's ideas and ideals is not merely a charity that we extend to others. It is not a condescension in a grudging manner of the attitudes of other people. It is an understanding and an affection one feels for the outlooks of others. When I agree with you, it does not mean I grudge and then somehow or other do not mind your ideas. That is a different thing, a negative accommodation. A positive accommodation is an appreciation of your point. I get on with you not because I somehow or other have to tolerate you. That is not the reason. I get on with you happily because I see in you a value which is dear to me also. This is a great vision indeed and hard to entertain in one's mind. Most people cannot see any meaning in the outlooks of their enemies, and some of the meanings which their own friends recognize in their own lives also are incapable of accommodation. I may have my friends, but I may not be able to appreciate all of their ideas and ideals. But if they are my enemies, I totally hate them. This is usually the tendency of man's mind. But the culture of Bharatavarsha has been entertaining an outlook of a different nature altogether. Hatred was not its policy. And I do not think even today India has a policy of hatred. Rather, there are people who think that its affection for other cultures is its weakness. Maybe it may turn out to be a weakness when it is expressed in an unintelligible or unintelligent manner. But the essence of it is not a weakness, it is a strength and a goodness. Even goodness has to be expressed in a good manner, because wisdom is the law of life finally. It is not ethics or a mere outward conduct that is to support us in our existence. The morality and the ethics of life is necessary, of course, but the wisdom of life is greater, which includes ethics and morality and transcends them in a wider interpretation of their significance, rather than merely their outer forms. Thus, to come to the point again, which I mentioned earlier, the culture of India has been an accommodating out. We may think that Indian culture is Hindu culture. Here again I have to divert a little to the word Hindu. There is no such thing as Hindu, really speaking. The Hindus are not Hindus, because that word does not exist in the culture of India. It was coined by people who came from outside India for designating the land which they saw and the people which were living in the country. Persians and the Greeks were the people who came first from outside India. And they had to cross the river Sindhu, which you call Indus today. They had no idea as to what sort of land it was extending beyond the river Sindhu. The Persian language requires the pronunciation of S as H. The Sindhu was regarded as the name of the country and the people and their culture, Hindu. So, S becoming H, Sindhu becomes Hindu. And Greek, H becomes I, Hindu becomes Ind. And Ind has become India and Indians, and Hindu still persists. So, what was the name of this country before these people came, and what was their culture called before they entered India? This is a different matter. I am just mentioning to you that the name of this country is not India. It has come to be called so by these accidents of history. And the people in India are not called Hindus. So there is no such thing as Hindu culture or even Indian culture in the general parlance. It was a culture which was associated with a vision of perfection. Sometimes, even today, people call it the vision of the Sanatana or the Eternal and the culture or the law that is associated with this eternity is oftentimes called, even now, as a Sanatana Dharma. But today, it means something different from what it originally meant. It has become a sectarian doctrine opposed to other doctrines. So, names are great problems these days. You cannot give any name to anything, because the moment you designate a thing by a particular name, it sets itself in opposition to others who have another name. And it is our labored intention to discover a non-opposing culture that is in India, the Bharatiya Sanskriti, or you may say culture of India. The culture of India, therefore, is such a comprehensive vision of the values of life that it is something which transcends the outlooks of the ordinary religions. We may say that the culture of India is not Hindu religion, if by religion you mean what Hinduism is in your mind at the present moment. If Indian culture were identical merely with Hinduism, it could not accommodate other religions. But we live peacefully with other religious cults and faiths. During the medieval times of India, ambassadors from the court of Queen Elizabeth came, and during the reign of Shivaji, other ambassadors from the countries of Europe came, and they were greeted and taken care of with such affection that they went with the tremendous encomium of the government of India at the time he prevailed. He read these histories with care, with great caution and care. There was no antipathy to the views of other people, because somehow in the blood of the people in India was ingrained a kind of toleration, born of an understanding that truth is multifaceted. Now, the multiformed vision of reality should naturally take into consideration the forms it takes in other cultures and other views of life, the prophets of the religions, which reign supreme in the world these days, naturally told the great truths. But don't you think they differ from one another? And we think that one religion is opposed to another religion because of the divergence of the codified instructions in their own gospels and the consequent conduct which people adopt in their own countries on the basis of these gospels of their own prophets. The geographical conditions and the historical circumstances of the times required a gospel of the type which was delivered by those great men during those hours. These religious preachings of the prophets, it may be of Buddha or Christ or Muhammad or anyone, were like prescriptions of a physician to the diseased human. When you are ill with a particular disease, a particular prescription is given. But if you are ill with another disease, the same prescription is not given to you. And to another individual, the same thing is not given. Something like this has been the reason behind the divergence of instructions of the prophets of the religions reigning supreme today. And it will be foolhardy and idiotic on the part of people to think that they represented a complete truth for eternity without any kind of requirement or change whatsoever, needing no amendment at all. It is difficult to believe that the prophets themselves believed it. If Acharya Shankara, Jesus Christ, Buddha and Muhammad and Zoroaster had a conference in a room, it would be difficult to believe that they would disagree with one another. They would have been so happy to meet each other in that conference. Each would be smiling at the other and embracing one another in the commonness of the vision that they had in their own selves, but manifested outwardly with certain limitations as would be required under the conditions geographically and socially. But the followers of the prophets spoil the religions. They cannot smile. On the other hand, they frown at other faiths, which was not the basic or the fundamental viewpoint or the standpoint on which India stood right from the time of the Vedas. There was somehow, for reasons which we cannot easily know today, a great spirit of accommodation and toleration in the minds of people here. So, in spite of social problems and political onslaughts, and ignorances of various types prevalent in the circles which are illiterate and dogmatic, dogma ridden, there is a spirit prevalent yet. The outward forms shake, but the spirit is stable even now. Thus it is that there is a hope which India is raising aloft as its banner, to whose light people turn their visions for guidance, even at this moment of time when the international situation may be said to be in a state of turmoil. Whenever people think of yoga or the religion of God, they remember India. It is something very mysterious. Why should they remember India and not any other country? It does not mean that India contains only religion and nothing else. It contains something more than religion is the reason. Religion is not adopted by India as a cult or a bifurcated pattern along the ruts of which it has to drive its vehicle of daily existence. To the vision of India, which would be the proper way we can describe the culture of India, the religious piety of the cults and the faiths was not merely an aspect of the vision which it held aloft, but a permeating influence which converted the whole of life into religion. And I read a very interesting line in a great work of Sri Aurobindo, which I like very much. People generally complain that India's fall is due to its religion. But I say, he says in his book, India has failed because of the lack of religion. It has somehow or other got into a quagmire and run into a blind alley. And maybe it has to pass through a period of test where it had to blink a little bit to the totality of the vision of religion which it entertained originally during the time of the Vedas and the Upanishads, and turn a blind eye due to a little repercussion which it had to bear during the vehement movements of the tempestuous winds that blew over its surface during the passage of time. It is difficult to maintain the vision of God throughout one's life. Even a prophet cannot maintain it. And a large country like this, to maintain this concentrated vision of totality of its religious attitude perpetually in every walk of life for all times would be a terrible job indeed. It failed many times. It could not understand. Many times Homer nods, as we are told, and India also nodded. And everyone nods, even great men nod. But even with this nod, it is not asleep, it awoke. Now and then it recovered from its slumber and got out of its bed of complacency and could remember the foundations of its outlook. And today we are living in the year 1980, not a happy year, not a happy day. We are not living in happy circumstances, either socially or politically or internationally. Notwithstanding all these problems, don't you think we have a ray of hope in our hearts? Are we weeping and crying that we are in hell? Though it appears as if we are in hell oftentimes, and we are likely to cry out, "Hell, get thee behind," as Christ said to Satan, yet even the most depressed, melancholy individual seems to have a little ray of positive hope. From where has this hope come? This is the foundation of our great culture, into whose mysteries we shall have time to dilate a little more.